The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. I am Pete Ledebus, all alone in the studio, except for Trent, who's working the big board for me. And this is basically just an excuse for you to not go to work, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Okay. I think Brad's here.
So. All right, and Brad may be here as well. And we were going to talk about today's topic, the patent game, with Andrew W. Torrens from the Kansas University Law Faculty, where he started in 2005. And the name patent game is a bit of a double entendre. It's about both the strategy in a general sense of using patents, but it also refers to an interactive simulation developed by Dr. Torrens to look at how people respond to patents, how they're used, the strategy, and in fact determine whether or not they really do help innovation the way we've always assumed about patents. He is unable to join us today because I just was not able to reach him. I think I talked to maybe his mom up in Ontario, Canada, and she gave me his BlackBerry number, and I don't know what's going on. And to be honest, I'd be more upset about this if it weren't for the fact that, you know, this is just the way life works.
And typical for our show.
What are you saying? we're just an unprofessional show?
It's just a very relaxed nature of the show, you know.
Okay, that's Brad who's just joined us. He's taking shots at me already. Actually, we got a big problem next week, because next week, are both you guys out of town?
I'm going to be. Are you?
Yeah.
I'm gonna be. Oh, man, that means you're going to have to run the board yourself.
I can't run the board myself. You've seen me run the board. It's a travesty.
People have heard you run the board yourself.
Look, what do we have, about 30 seconds of dead air time? That one
30.
Time? It wasn't that bad, was it? I don't know. I cut it out in the archives, so no one will ever notice if they listen to a rebroadcast of the show. But next week, at least in theory, we're finalizing things now. We may actually have
a guest,
Dr. Karen Panetta, calling in from Tufts University, who is the founder of Nerd Girls.
Oh, right.
As seen recently in Newsweek magazine, The Today Show, and MSNBC.
Cool.
So, will we be able to get anyone in here?
We'll find someone. We'll find someone.
But it's basically the break. And that's why Dr. Panetta can do the show, because it's the break before Tufts classes start as well. I mean, is there anyone who's so just as pathetic as I am, they have no life and they will be here?
I'm sure we could find someone.
All right, so there it is, ladies and gentlemen. Georgia Tech. Filled with people whose lives are so pathetic, they will, in fact, will be able to find someone.
I think communications and marketing is going to love that statement from you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Communications at Georgia Tech?
Yeah.
Well, I'm just picking on the students, right? I mean,
sure.
All right, but look, you got to take everything with a grain of salt, right? I mean, it's just a joke.
That's what the disclaimer is for.
Right? And, I mean, doesn't communications and marketing realize it's just a joke? That we point out we are nerdy. But look, we've got, you know, people in here who are mathematicians and engineers who still find time to do the radio. Right, and it's not like you get paid the big bucks to do this, right? You do this just because you want to engage the public, right? Brad's thinking. Why do you do this, Brad?
For you, Pete, for you.
Okay, that's a scary thought, because you're a nice guy, but I don't think you're my type.
that's a little scary.
No, and it is kind of scary. I actually did, I was telling Trent, I did a independent retired living place last night doing comedy there, and we did not connect very well.
No, didn't go out.
No, did not go over too well. And I'm a little disappointed because I actually went and wrote a new musical number for these guys.
A musical number?
Did you know I do a musical
number? No, I didn't.
Right, I do a thing to Phantom of the Opera about awkward moments in the sperm sample collection room for infertility conferences. That always goes over well. And it's funny, speaking of jokes, I do a bit on fathers who finally come to the realization that their teenage daughters will begin dating, right? And my daughter's 13 years old, and, you know, she'll start dating in a few years. And I do a spoof on Janie's Got a Gun by Aerosmith. It's called Daddy's Got a Gun. Because
mm-hmm.
I have actually had colleagues recommend to me that I go buy a large caliber handgun and, you know, clean it when little Jimmy comes over to pick her up for a date. Has that ever happened to you guys?
Shotguns work way better.
Okay, shotguns. I'm not a big gun aficionado, so Trent's recommending, you know.
I'm from the north, so we don't really have shotguns in our house, or, you know.
Okay. Is that a dig at the South?
I'm sure. Take it with a grain of salt. It's only a joke.
Right, that's the whole point. So I sing this song, and my daughter hates it. In fact, she ran Lights and Sound at that show last night, and she basically said, look, you cannot admit that I'm your daughter. You cannot admit that you even know me, that I'm just the sound person, and that's it. Because whenever I sing that song, she's so embarrassed. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not a gun guy, so I don't think I would ever do that. I mean, I would embarrass her date in a plethora of ways, but not with the gun thing. So
was it a good stand-up, or what happened?
Well, I had my friend Mike Carr opening for me, and, you know, he did a lot of his stuff that gets a lot of laughs. And like I said, I wrote a new song. The new song was Music of the Night, but it was Urges of the Night, about having to get up to, you know, use the restroom in the middle. Like, oh, you're laughing already.
And did they like it or no?
Well, the bartender liked it. The staff liked it. The few people under the age of 70 that were there, maybe to visit their parents.
And the ones above 70, did they have a pulse or
no? I don't know. I mean, they just sat there with their arms folded staring at me most of the time. And I tried all sorts of different materials. I sort of shift topics, you know, 15 times. Yeah, I went to the audience. I tried to get a response out of this. Yes, just nothing. I don't know. And it's a very nice place. Actually, I don't want to mention it, but it's a very nice place. And I was hoping for more interaction. Because I'll tell you, I scouted this, right, as any good scientist or engineer does, right? You go do your research, don't you?
Should.
Or comedian.
So, right, same thing. So I went and talked to my mom. My mom's 81 years old. And my mom's the one that sends me most of the dirty jokes I come across. And I say, Mom, where do you get all these dirty jokes? And she says, get them from my friend, who's 83. Mm-hmm. So, I don't think old people want anything, you know, really nasty. I don't think they want a lot of swearing, but they're adults. They're drinking. There was a bar. I mean, so, I don't know. But we just totally bombed. And here's the killer. I did bring my 8-year-old son, Dylan, because he likes this. He does like 2 minutes between me and the opening act, and he's the only one that really got laughs last night, because he's 8. He's cute. So no matter what jokes he tells, he goes, okay, my name's Dylan, I'll be here all week. And he gets off stage, and just, you know, everyone likes that, and particularly older people like that. So he got a lot of laughs. And then he's rubbing it in on the way home. So, you know, I agreed to pay him $20 to do that. and he goes, well, I think I should get more, because I'm the only one that got laughs. So he talked me up to 30, and that's where I thought he was getting greedy.
Wow,
there,
true so. Businessman.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he's really good, but he seems to enjoy it. And like I said, he put me and my friend Mike Carr to shame. All right, so, Brad, in case you're wondering what the heck we're doing here, we're doing the Potpourri Show. We used to do this at Radio Sandy Springs.
Potpourri. Or is that when you don't have anything better you just pick up?
No, what is potpourri? Sort of dried floral plant matter that you pour hot oil on to get it to circulate the scent. You know what potpourri is, right?
I know what potpourri is. I heard it in that context where you pour oil on it.
My
mom just threw out potpourri and be like, all right, there's potpourri. We don't pour oil on it.
Well, I mean, sometimes that actually helps get the smell out there. So,
okay. You're making like a soup?
No, you're not making a soup. You just pour a little out. It's still a dried floral kind of thing. But I guess potpourri.
There's some garlic in there, some
goes
olives.
Goes back to the days of Alex Trebek, even before Alex Trebek, Jeopardy, right? You remember there's always a category on Jeopardy, potpourri. Yeah. That means whatever junk these guys came up with, they couldn't put it in another category. But look, our guest abandoned us. And as you pointed out.
Did you try and call him?
Yeah, we did try. We tried calling him twice. We tried calling his BlackBerry. I did have a nice chat with the person I believe to be his mother was very nice.
So you should put her on the show.
Maybe we should. She was very nice. Perhaps she's very knowledgeable about intellectual property law. Before we go one step further, ladies and gentlemen, in case you are joining us for this fascinating potpourri category show. And I have a question about science. And we do have a couple science in the news articles, so we'll start with that in a second. This is what's called in the comedy business filling. We're filling.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Okay. By all means, if you're listening to this
comedy and education.
What do we call it again? Potpourri Show. Give us a call here at WREK 404-894-2468. See, I wrote the number down.
All right.
Sorry.
All right.
I got it because it's only on that side of the board. Once again, that's 404-894-2468.
How long have you been here?
If you've got a we've been here a few months now.
All right, just wondering.
Is that another Alzheimer's crack? Like the one you sent me via email? And by the way, Metamucil does not fix Alzheimer's.
Oh,
are you implying that that's where my brains are? I don't know. All right, this is where the FCC gives us a call. But once again, 404-894-2468. Or if you're listening to us on the web, that's WREK.org. The number's there. Give us a call if you have any questions.
I want to talk about something.
What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about green energy.
green energy? Is that like green eggs and ham? Or?
Maybe, if you want to make it green eggs.
All right, what do you want to talk about green energy?
Like, I don't get how politicians today can, you know, they're making bills such that we drill more oil. Is that really the issue? Like, drilling more oil is going to solve our problems? Or is it green energy? Because, to me, it's like wind energy, hydrogen energy is free, renewable.
Right.
Why don't we go in that direction than having to rely on oil? I don't get it. But then you could talk about the science of, you know, wind turbines. Like, I'm really interested in wind turbines and that different stuff.
But. Well, so, I mean, just talking about this in a very general way, because I'm no expert on wind turbines, so I'm gonna give you that caveat. Right, Trent's laughing now. He goes, I'm a mathematician. Unless, you know, it's in the computer and I can express it as a Riemann sum, it doesn't exist to me. So, well, first of all, I mean, I think the political issue, I don't understand the political issue. Are you confused by the political issue as well? I mean,
I'm not confused by political issues.
I think politicians are, can I say dopes without getting...
Sure,
why not? And that's not really true. They're not dopes, but they have a different motivation, right? Their motivation is to make their constituents happy and get reelected, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, making their constituents happy, that's okay. That's good. But I guess what bothers me is we've sort of lost the good citizen, right? Way back when in the 60s and 50s, we used to take a class in high school and middle school called civics that would attempt to address this stuff.
We still take that today, but...
Do you still take that today?
I took it when I was in high school.
What did they cover? What did they cover in civics when you were in high school?
Like all political stuff.
Right. But I mean, did they talk about the responsibility of the citizen and things like that?
Not in such a way that it's so patriotic that you just want to run to the top of a mountain.
Making forceful gestures with our arms when we do that. I don't know. I think politicians realize that people are mad because gas was over $4 a gallon. And you notice already it's below $4 a gallon and people aren't so mad anymore? But what,
we'll see.
I guess the group has a short-term memory. Because I remember odd even gas rationing under Jimmy Carter.
Mm-hmm.
So depending on what your license plate ended in, you got to go on an odd or even day. And people were siphoning gas all over the place. That's where you learned about these little spirally metal things that you'd put in your gas tube, where you pour your gas in. And that would prevent people from siphoning gas because you couldn't get the siphon all the way down. And that's going to happen again if gas stays this high.
So have you heard about Boone Pickens, the oil guy?
Yeah, Boone Pickens, the former corporate raider. Yeah, he's big on oil.
The BP Capital guy.
Yeah. So he has come out recently and said, look, and much of what he said is very accurate. He said, look, drilling here and expanding the drilling operations here may not necessarily do all that much. And that's because most people don't realize that when you drill an oil well, it very rarely do you get this gusher, right? And after a well's been developed for many, many years, you don't have that kind of back pressure at all, right?
Yeah.
There's not giant, you know, million-gallon pools of oil that have a gas pocket on top of them that just shoot the oil out.
Yeah.
Most of the oil that comes out in this country, and Boone Pickens pointed this out when he was actually talking on TV a few weeks ago, that you have to pump, you know, slurries of water and these things called fracture fluids like guar gum. It's just polysaccharides that go into the fissure of the rock and crack them open. And what comes out is more water and polymer slurry than oil, right? And then you got to separate that stuff. So our oil wells don't produce quite like a lot of Middle Eastern oil wells where they are more oil and less stuff you pump down there to get it out. So, and I guess one of the problems people say is, you know, they have millions and millions of acres of leases now, but a lot of those leases won't produce anything.
Yeah.
So, you know, drilling is very, very expensive. Exploration is what they've done for a lot of these things. And exploration, they go in and they do all sorts of stuff. There's a lot of different ways to do this, but basically you blow off an explosion and you take a lot of very fancy sensors to look and see how that shock wave, that vibration, goes through the ground. And if it's something that's different than dirt or rock, like a big cavity of gas or liquid, well, then you can tell something. And there are some potential oil fields offshore.
Yeah.
And let me preface this with my opinion. My opinion is, and I'm a very green guy. You know, I'm sort of a liberal Democrat guy. I've never been a big fan of going up to the Arctic Refuge and drilling there. But I am not necessarily against a little offshore drilling in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine, but I think the resources and technologies out there for a greener society where, I mean, you don't have to call it green. It's just more economically efficient society where, you know, we rely on
sustainable,
whatever tomato you want to call it. But it's, you know, you're relying on renewable energy such that you don't have to worry about gas. You could just set up a wind turbine, use the power from a wind turbine,
power your car, power your house.
Yeah.
You know, it's just people are, you know.
Yeah, so I think we should be doing some drilling offshore. I think we should be expanding the number of nuclear power plants in the United States. I think we should be looking at wind energy, solar energy, you know, the hydrogen economy. The hydrogen economy is kind of a boondoggle because hydrogen as a gas is nice and easy to put in your car and drive around. And I know people are thinking, oh, my God, it's hydrogen. And they remember back to the Hindenburg crash and things like that. Well, the truth is you wouldn't just put it in a high-pressure 3,000 PSI tank. You'd have it absorbed at lower pressure on something called a metal hydride. And, yeah, it wouldn't take, you know, 5 minutes to fill up your tank, but it might take, you know, 10 or 15. Basically, they were shooting for the amount of time it would, you know, you would take to consume a scone and some coffee.
Right? Yeah.
And we could certainly live with that. So hydrogen is an answer. The problem with hydrogen is if you produced it from water, right, so electrolysis, basically an electrode can very easily make oxygen and hydrogen. And let's face it, the oxygen would have, you know, useful, would have many uses as
hospitals,
well.
Hospitals, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. That would, I mean, basically, to get that much electricity, you would have to just, I'm going to joke here. So, because I can't give you the exact answer, you know, build a nuclear power plant, you know, in every small town in the United States, or burn enough coal to blot out the sun. And that's paraphrasing actually what a number of reports have actually said, the amount of stuff we'd have to do that. I've actually heard politicians talk about separating hydrogen from hydrocarbons, which I think is nuts, because then you get the carbon left over, and probably the way the carbon would come out is as oxidized carbon or carbon monoxide and dioxide, which are greenhouse gases. And that's the beauty of that hydrogen cycle, is no more CO2.
Mm.
The odd thing is, people don't realize this, that things like methane and water are also greenhouse gases. So if we put enough water in the air, that would create a greenhouse effect as well. The nice thing is that can actually condense and come down as rain, so it's probably not as bad as carbon dioxide.
So,
but
let me ask you this question then. Do you see, like, in 5 or 10 years, then we being, or maybe they say 70 by 2070, I think it is, that will be a totally sustainable economy? Do you see that happening? Or
2070? The answer is yes, if we're willing to make the sacrifices.
Well, what's the sacrifice, though?
Well, the sacrifice is to literally take billions and billions of dollars and put it into something that in the past the United States and the world in general has done pretty well, and that's innovate. Mm. So, you know, solar cells right now are not very efficient. They're much more efficient than they were, you know, a few decades ago. And, oh, my God, we haven't even taken a break.
Yeah, we'll take a break in a little while.
All right, we'll take a break in a little while. I mean, okay, it's not like we don't have a big long list of advertisers queuing up to sponsor the show. I don't know. All right, what were we even talking about there?
I don't know.
You're talking about efficiency.
It's all timers going.
Oh, yeah. So whether it's wind energy or solar or any of these things, that technology still needs to be improved. And if you plot out how much it's improved over the last few decades, if you throw enough money at it, and this includes things like fuel cells, right? I mean, fuel cells, it's a great idea, theoretically, but we have problems with the catalysts that make these reactions happen, getting poisoning. The proton exchange membrane that lets, you know, the what is it, the protons go through. That's part of the electrolytic cell. Well, the catalysts are.
Yeah.
But the proton exchange membranes, we have real problems with that. But that's nothing that a few decades and a few billion dollars isn't likely to fix.
I mean,
but we got to take that money and we have to invest it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
So here's my question. Where's that? So you're AFROTC, right? Or XAFR2, are you?
Yeah.
I mean,
was.
Well, in any case, I mean, scientists all around the United States are just cringing at what we could do for a month or two here and there with the cost of the war in terms of National Institutes of Health, National Science Foundation, all this sort of stuff. You know, I'm not a big fan of borrow and spend, but if you were going to borrow that money and put it toward, you know, improving wind energy, improving solar cells, improving, simple things like fuel cells. We've got a problem with fuel cells. The most feasible technology is either really, really high temperature, or the stuff that operates at low temperature always has water in it. And what are you going to do with a car in Alaska that has water in its fuel cell?
Mm.
Right. I mean, Alaska's so bad that you have an oil pan warmer just to keep the oil from getting too thick, right? Mm. You pull into the convenience store, you plug it in. They actually have a post with a little electric plug. So the answer is yes, I believe we can do this, but it's going to take a lot of money and it's going to take time and it's going to take a shift in mentality to back during the 60s and, yeah, maybe the 60s, the 50s and the 60s, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you guys have heard the term rocket scientists, right?
Yeah.
And
thousands of them here.
Well, but that's the thing, though. I mean, it's like, what's the one country song? You know, so you're a rocket scientist. I mean, rocket scientists used to mean something back then. When we were in the middle of the space race, when the Soviet Union got Sputnik up there first, and that was a matter of national pride, and we put a lot of resources into it, and a lot of people were studying science and engineering and math and wanted to do this sort of thing. And now I don't see that we have that, particularly in light of the National Academy of Engineering report we talked about on the show a few weeks ago about the public perception of engineering.
Right.
So we need to get in a totally different mindset. And when we do that, yeah, I think we can. The question is, I mean, what socially is going to make us do that?
I don't know. The next generation of... Young
you are
bucks.
The next. Aren't you guys the next generation?
Yeah, we were.
But, I mean, then you have to, like, I mean, it's a whole big, you know, I guess, picture when you think about green energy and then the cost of oil and how much we're sending overseas and then how much we're sending to China in the way of a trade deficit and things like that. So, I mean.
Well, here's the interesting thing. I take issue with the people that say, well, you know, the United States used to be a manufacturing economy. Well, that's true. And then they said that more recently we're a service economy. I'm not sure that's really what we do. I think we're an innovation engine. That's what the United States does. So having traveled to different parts of the world and seen other economies like Japan that do extremely well, the one thing we do better than anyone is innovation. And I don't just mean science and technology. I mean innovation in business and marketing and how you do that, that sort of stuff. Just organizational structures.
Yeah.
And we are not doing that anymore. I don't think it's encouraged. I don't think it's taught. I don't think there are financial incentives from places like the National Science Foundation necessarily to do that sort of thing. And the more we neglect funding things, you know, fundamental research, not even just applied, because it's the fundamental research that will tell you down the road how I can make a polymer allow only protons to get, you know, and protons are just a H plus ion, right? I mean, these are the things that complete the circuit in a fuel cell to go through, but not have the methane or the hydrogen or the other stuff go through as well, right? It's a semi-permeable membrane. Yeah. You only have stuff going one way. And, you know, I just don't think we're doing enough to fix that right now.
So, I mean, you're saying that we're kind of an innovative society, whereas now there's not as much incentive or financial incentive to be one?
And part of it is just national pride. I mean, you know, in the 50s and the 60s, everybody wanted to be a rocket scientist.
So, I mean, it's basically science and technology in the K through 12s, right?
Yeah, that's part of it.
I mean...
But, I mean, I talk to a lot of people in K through 12, and people are like, why should I be a scientist or an engineer when I can go out to Hollywood and get my own reality TV series? I think, okay, there it is, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to go out on a limb and say reality TV is killing science and technology in this country. You're not going to get a more controversial statement than that. If you disagree with that, if you think I should be institutionalized, if you think Brad and Trent should be institutionalized, give us a call to talk about this and other issues in science and technology. And let's take a break when we come back. I'll actually bring up the original Science in the News articles I had. But by all means, give us a call at 404-894-2468. You're listening to Inside the Black Box on WREK Atlanta.
On the first Sunday of every month, tune in to WREK for the iDrum Archive Sunday Special. Drawing from years' worth of performances at the downtown performance space, you'll hear improvisational jazz, electronic, punk, and all sorts of music captured live. For more information about iDrum, visit their website at www.eyedrum.org. Again, that's the iDrum Archive Sunday Special, the first Sunday of every month at 7 p.m. right here on WREK Atlanta 91.1 FM.
This is Friction.
Alfie, I think we may have a mayday situation on our hands. We've grabbed a bunch of cars back here at the mines, and we can't hold them. She's waiting on us there. How's number 14?
14 left passes at 0818. Over.
Okay, let us know she's by hippie there. West way there, might be able to hold her, and she might be right out on the main line.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, all right. How many cars is there? Yep, over.
She has a hold of a 30.
Right there now, 50. She's going 50, and I got no control of her.
You got no control of her, Wesley? Are you a couple to those cars, over?
Friction Wednesday, 10 p.m. on WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box and our first ever on WREK Potpourri show. And apparently now we're talking about sustainable energy. So, like I said before the break, give us a call if you've got a question or comment about anything in science, 404-894-2468. And Trent was pointing out that, what is this, a company in your building?
Oh, yeah. It does some kind of green energy thing. I'm not really sure. But I'm just saying they instantly got more funding than any other, like, people combined.
Yeah, because it's hot right now.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Right.
And I guess my only issue with the startup company getting funding from investors is that...
it's more like venture capital.
And that's okay. Yeah. But, I mean, venture capitalists, or as we used to call them when I minored this in graduate school, vulture capitalists, they want their money back, right? So I'm just not sure we're at the stage with some of this stuff that the business model works.
Sure.
Right? And we might be there in 5 years. We might be there in 10 years. I mean, there's a point where you need to do very, very fundamental, you know, physics and chemistry of this stuff and engineering before you can get to the point where someone can take it, innovate it at the applications level, and then get money and make money for those guys. I think we're a few years away from that.
When I was on the flight from China to America, there was a special on the Delta screen, whatever, about green energy. And this guy had created his whole house. It was like a normal house, and he was powering it through solar panels and using that energy then to create hydrogen, which then he used to create a hydrogen car.
Yeah.
It was all sustainable within his own home.
Yeah. And there are a lot of people that believe that we shouldn't be doing the giant scale solar panel stuff until we improve these. But that person, you can do a lot of that stuff. Yeah. And there are a lot of states where you can, if you create excess energy via your wind turbine or something, you can actually get credit for that back on the electrical grid.
Sure. Yeah, they'll pay you for it.
Yeah, and I think that's great. But most of those people have to undergo a lifestyle change. So before, and I'm not talking about some weird operation you get in Sweden. I'm talking about your life changes.
Sure.
Right? When you change the way you get energy. And, you know, we talked about sacrifices. One will be sort of the cultural one, and then there'll be the economic one. And this is a lifestyle change that, you know, there are times when you have a lot of consumption of energy. You know, maybe it's me charging my cordless nose hair trimmer. I don't know. And you've got a bank of batteries that gets charged up, and you might just run out of that stuff, right? You may have to start the gas power generator or something. I don't know. Mm. But your life does change to some degree. There is an additional cost. You have to worry about the maintenance of that stuff. And I think that's the sacrifice we haven't been willing to make yet. You know, I'm actually, with gas still near $4 a gallon, I'm thinking of just taking MARTA in every day. And I think I've done the numbers. At $4 a gallon, I'm not losing money, and I might be making money. So do you think the average American is ready to make that change?
Well, see, the change, I think that's what's going to happen is when wind energy or whatever green energy starts to become prominent, then the price of oil is going to start to go down because there's going to be less demand for it. Right. In which case, then people are going to be like, okay, I don't want to change, so then I'm going to stick to oil.
Exactly.
And so it's going to be just this topsy-turvy thing where we're going to be in this, you know, in between until someone actually says, all right, you know.
But that's easy to fix. I mean, what the government can do is simply keep the price of oil artificially high and just make it up with taxes and then take that taxes to fund incentives for green energy. That's how Europe does it. I mean, actually, we're still not as high as Europe.
Oh,
right?
No.
We are still not near.
It's like $8 a gallon.
So. Yeah, I mean, and whatever price they give you, that's usually per liter, by
the
way.
Yeah, so. I had some friends who recently went to, like, Scotland, and they were talking. They went to the sign, and they said, oh, okay, this isn't so bad. It's only, like, 5 or something.
Right.
But then I've been like, oh, wait, it's by liter, so that's entirely.
Yeah, exactly. So it's obscene in Europe, but what they've done is most of that is taxes.
Right.
And that taxes goes to support the rail and subway and train infrastructure they have there. So you can get a train anywhere in Europe. I mean, that's what I like about the trains. And now, even to some degree, you can get planes that are relatively cheap, just going zipping back and forth between countries. Sure. So I don't mind if it's $4 a gallon or more, and a lot of that's going to taxes to fund exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. So that's easy to fix. But here's the thing. What politician is going to say that, okay, gas is $4 a gallon, I am not going to let it get below $3.80 or $4 a gallon, and the rest we're going to make up in taxes to get us moving in the right direction? Who is going to get that? I think that's a smart thing to do. I think that's the right thing to do, but nobody's going to vote for that.
Of course not. That's why they're going to, was it Anwar to drill more oil up there?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of going to Alaska. I think that's, I don't know. So how do we fix this problem? This is not a technological problem. I think this is something that can be fixed via technology and science if we put enough resources on
it.
How do you get people to say, I have to make a sacrifice and not drive that giant... Okay, this is an oxymoron to me, is the hybrid SUV. I don't get the hybrid SUV. I mean, now everybody wants to get a hybrid SUV and... Okay, yeah, you got an electric motor, but you're just burning that much more gas to generate enough electricity to store it to run this giant thing. And, you know, let me say this. Nothing against trucks and SUVs. If you are a tradesperson, right, you know, you are a plumber and you need that King, what is it, crew cab to get your guys in there, and you got to put a lot of pipe and ladders in the back. Yeah, that's totally reasonable. Yeah. Get a truck. Get a big step van, you know, put those 19 ladders on the top. They're like ready to fall off on Route 75. That's totally reasonable, but I don't think the, you know, and a Chevy Suburban, right? It's this giant gas guzzling thing, but there is a reason to have a Chevy Suburban. Like you own a ranch or something, or don't you think? I mean, there are people that need a car that big with that kind of ground clearance, but a soccer mom in Cobb County where I live does not.
Or a Hummer for that matter.
Or don't even get me started on the Hummer.
But. Aren't they? Yeah. I mean, isn't society making a change by higher fuel costs, and then they're not buying trucks? Because I know, like, closing down?
Ford is closing down all these trucks and big SUVs, and they're making exactly the kind of cars that I saw when I lived in Europe that they made. In fact, if you go to
they're small.
You never saw any American cars except for Fords. Yeah. Fords sold extremely well over there. Because people buy the Fiat Cinquecento, this tiny little... we talk about, what's that thing, the commuter car? And they had cars almost that small in Europe for decades. Yeah. And that's because gas is almost as much in liters as it is in gallons.
And even most of them still use scooters, too.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, a good friend of mine who's an intelligent person with a PhD, she once said to me, I could never own a minivan. And she's married with two kids. She drives a giant Suburban. I think it's status. I mean, what happens if you go riding on the street on a Vespa, which is one of the better-selling kind of scooters in Europe and Italy especially, do they ask you to check your man card at the door? They would, wouldn't they?
Yes.
Yeah, they would. I admit that. I actually thought about getting a scooter when gas prices were really high, and they're like, no, you got to get a motorcycle. But, I don't know, if I had a motorcycle, then I'd be tempted to drive it on the highway, and if I drove it on the highway, I'd have to quadruple my insurance. I mean, you know what they call a guy my age driving a motorcycle?
Organ donor.
Organ donor. You got it. So, I don't know. I mean, is it just status? Is it... That's the lifestyle change I'm talking about. How do we get Americans to do that?
Well, I don't know. I think it's a bigger picture kind of thing.
Yeah. So,
eventually either oil prices will go up and we're going to continue to go into a recession.
Yeah.
In which cases, then... they're going to have to make a change. Otherwise, they're going to be, I mean, you don't have a job or, you know, drive a smaller car.
Right. And in Europe, they move a lot of things via rail, which we don't use as much. But what a lot of people don't realize is that most of those trucks you see will eventually, you know, unhook the truck and put it on this piggyback car on railroads.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we just don't use enough of that. And what was it? Somebody, it might have been GE who makes locomotives, but somebody pointed out... Yeah. That if you move a car, you know, in a big rail car, what it costs per mile. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, a few cents a mile to move it that way as opposed to actually driving it. So, I don't know. Did we actually get a call, or was that someone calling to complain to the FCC?
404-894-2468 for any calls or questions.
Okay. And, are we better or worse than just, what was that, random jazz that was on before? What would we normally have during this hour?
I'm not sure. Might be rock and roll.
All right. Well, here's a Science in the News article that we're going to start with. It's
45
from,
minutes later.
As we often do, the Tuesday Science Times. This was from Tuesday, July 29th. An article entitled "The Jetpack from Comics to Liftoff in the Yard" by John Schwartz. And it starts out, Dateline Oshkosh, Wisconsin, which, by the way, is the site of a huge fly-in every year. So a lot of aviation folks like to go up there for this big fly-in. To rise off the ground wearing a jetpack is to feel the force of dreams. Very, very noisy. Dreams. On Tuesday, an inventor from New Zealand unveiled what he calls the world's first practical jetpack at EAA AirVenture, the gigantic annual air show here. The inventor, Glenn Martin, 48, who has spent 27 years developing the device, has said he hoped to begin selling them next year at $100,000 apiece. And you, Brad,
did you see
his head.
Did you
actually
watch
it? I read this article in the New York Times.
But did you actually watch a video of the thing taking off?
No, I didn't watch the video. So,
to me, it looked like the most impractical thing ever.
Oh, really?
It was like...
So why was it impractical?
I think it was two propeller-driven.
Yeah,
it was
they're two actually fans.
Two
yeah,
fans,
turbofans, right.
And then I didn't think it had any controls whatsoever, any stability controls, because he had to be...
Oh.
The person that was flying it, which was his son, had to be held... Like, two people had to, like, actually hold the contraption while it moved. So it was, like, there was no, like, stability to it.
Yeah.
And then I saw another video of an actual jetpack where the guy was actually flying around.
Yeah.
But it was, like, more inefficient than anything. It was, like...
Yeah.
Well, this one's supposed to go for, like, what, $100,000? And then the other one, I think, is supposed to be, like, $200,000. But it gets, like, maybe 2 miles to the gallon.
Well, yeah, the old ones were really bad. I mean, they were literally an oxidizer and a fuel that had sort of a ramjet. This is not even a jetpack. It's a fan. It's two turboprops, right? Actually, I don't even think they're turbines. It's two probably internal combustion engine fans, right, that do it. But it does seem like a more elegant version of what people fly now, which is the ultralight helicopter. And let's see, what was it? Mad Max? Where you had that one guy and that little mini helicopter flying around?
Yeah.
And usually they have two countercurrent rotating blades, and they're very low, so it's kind of dangerous. So I have a friend, Dennis, who's always trying to get me an ultralight aircraft, and that's an ultralight version of the aircraft. So
those are pretty cool.
Yeah, so I think they're cool. The problem is with the planes, you need some space for them to take off. And you need space that's free from an overhead power line, which is hard to find in Georgia. So the helicopter's nice, but the helicopter has two exposed blades that come up to about your abdomen. Right? The nice thing about a big helicopter, you always see these guys ducking their heads. Usually those blades are above their heads. If you had blades at the middle of your chest and you walked into that, that would be an ugly scene.
Right.
So here, at least they're held inside what they called cupcake-like holders. So. So, I don't know. To me, it's the more elegant version of that. And he is working on, you know, things beyond the prototype that he's working with now. They now have what's called ballistic parachutes, which is kind of nice because if it malfunctions. I've seen videos of this. If you get an ultralight, you know, one of these little, you know, tricycle three-wheeled planes you're flying, and all of a sudden the engine just falls out or just cuts out. I've even seen when they're flying, they call them a ballistic parachute because a charge shoots it out really, really fast.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden this thing comes out, stops it dead in its tracks, and you just float down to Earth. So I would never do an ultralight.
You hear about the Cirrus 22?
No.
The type of aircraft, a single engine, low wing aircraft, has an actual parachute on it. So when engine stops, release the parachute, shoot it up. And safely go down.
Oh, yeah. So ballistic parachutes can be used for small planes. I've seen it deployed on a Cessna single.
Yeah,
So
there's a guy who was in over the Hudson River up in New York City, had a heart attack, couldn't land the aircraft.
I saw that. Yeah.
And shot the
ballistic parachute. Some of them, they'll be based on altimeters or other sensors and things like that. Okay. All right. So that was practical, but nobody's biting that one. We still think it's Brad still thinks it's impractical.
What?
Well, I'm not paying $100,000 for it. That's
right. No.
Because you can buy an ultralight kit and all this
the fixings
for 20 grand, maybe 10 grand to put that thing together. But aircraft run at least $100,000, don't they? In a single
even
engine.
Cheaper. It's like, I mean, you get a Cessna 172 for $50,000.
But
an older one.
That would be used. Yeah. Okay.
Jeez. A brand new car.
Is this a purchase you're thinking of? You're right, actually. Yeah, SUVs cost that much almost.
I'm a pilot's license.
Where did you find the time to do it?
High school.
Wow, that must be nice. Then where did you find the money to do it?
Daddy.
Man, that's convenient.
Right. Well, it's part of my education, you know, because
it's good.
If I want to go on a track towards being an airline pilot, you got to learn somewhere.
Yeah, right? I agree. So, I mean, if I had the time and the money, I'd do it too.
Yeah, you know, where do you go to get an engineering degree?
Right. So. Wow. So are you going to pursue that dream of flight and airline pilot stuff? Or?
Yes. It's always a possibility.
Okay. All right, so let's take something a little more fundamental and theoretical. The other one was from the same July 29th Science in the News article, an article by Kenneth Chang called The Nature of Glass Remains Anything But Clear. And I don't know if we're going to put people to sleep on this. and they start out with a misnomer that we debunked on this show about a month ago. It's well known that panes of stained glass in old European churches are thicker at the bottom because glass is a slow-moving fluid that flows downward over centuries. Well known but wrong, medieval stained glass makers were simply unable to make perfectly flat panes, and the windows were just unevenly thick when new. And the hypothesis is that, you know, when you carry it, you carry the thicker, heavier part at the bottom. It's easier to put it in the window that way, so that makes sense. The tale contains a grain of truth about glass resembling a liquid, the article goes on. However, the arrangement of atoms and molecules in glass is indistinguishable from that of a liquid. But how can a liquid be as strikingly hard as a glass? And it really, the article goes on talking about all sorts of people like Peter Wolnes, who was a physical chemistry teacher, a lot of my friends at the University of Illinois when I was there, and their theories about glasses, right? So the window pane glass there, and when you melt it, if you look at how the atoms are packed, it's very subtle difference between these things.
Okay.
And polymers do the same thing. So most clear polymers, polystyrene, your bottles for holding water and soda, polyethylene terephthalate, they are amorphous solids. So they're glasses, too, right? Yeah. And the interesting thing about the silicon oxide glasses that are in the window is they don't relax as quickly, but polymers do. And polymers do because they're more complicated molecules. And there are other things that can move, even though you're below this hardening point called the glass transition temperature. So in theory, glasses don't melt. They go through something called the glass transition temperature. It's like melting, but it's very, very broad. It has some different thermodynamic characteristics. And more importantly, it's a function of how quickly you cool it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you cool it quickly, you get a very, very high glass transition temperature. And if you cool it very slowly, you can go to this infinitely slow limit that Dr. Wolnes talks about.
That's due to the Gibbs free energy, is that right? Or no?
Well, I mean, it has to do with entropy, right? Yeah, and part of Gibbs free energy is both the energy and the entropy.
Right.
And, you know, entropy is a weird thing. Here's the problem. The article talks about the fact that glasses are very poorly understood. I would agree with that. But for all intents and purposes, the glass transition temperature and this infinitely slow cooling version of it means nothing to us because we will never get a glass that is that way. And they did point out that some recent experiments point out that when things turn into a glass, they don't do it homogeneously. They don't suddenly become slow in energy. Right. The only difference between that glass and the melt of that glass is the molecules are moving around more when you're in the melt. And the same with polymers. That when they coalesce into this solid-like substance, they don't do it homogeneously. They start doing it in little bits and pieces, but not like a crystal, right? And the article actually points out that these are very different than, say, water, which crystallizes. The neat thing about water is, though, if you cool it quick enough, you can turn water into a glass. And we have done that. If you go to the internet, look up amorphous ice, you can find pictures of this thing. And it does look slightly clearer than regular ice.
What do you mean glass? Like glass such that, you know, the window I'm looking at right now, it's the same thing? Or is this like just ice glass where it's
so
like
the
it can melt?
So the between a solid that's a crystal and a solid that's a glass or an amorphous solid is exactly that. It's amorphous. It is without structure.
Right.
So the molecules would be willy-nilly in all different directions, whereas most phases of water, you've got, you know, the hydrogens and oxygens all pointed in a certain way, and that repeats over distances for very large amounts, right? I mean, nothing is a perfect crystal, but it's, you know, you have big chunks that are exactly the same way in their packing. Whereas amorphous ice looks like liquid ice. They're random, but it's a solid. So the key is, a lot of these it's easy to make a lot of polymers into glasses, but small molecules, they relax and rearrange and pack so quickly because they're small, it's hard to make them into a glass. But you can make water into a glass on the surface of a comet.
On the surface of what?
On the surface of a comet.
Comet?
Yeah, so you've got, you know, water degassing from some vent in the comet, and all of a sudden, the sun sets on it, and it goes from hundreds or thousands of degrees to well below zero, whether you're measuring it in centigrade or Fahrenheit, in, you know, a very, very short period of time. And that's quick enough to get these things to form a glass. But the interesting thing about these glasses is they pointed out that misnomer at the beginning of the program that these things, silicon oxide glass has such strong interactions that it doesn't really relax on the time frame of decades or centuries to an appreciable degree. Now, we could wait enough time and it would eventually flow. But polymer glasses, because say, for example, take a CD, right? Mm-hmm. A compact disc, a DVD. The base of that is bisphenol A polycarbonate, which we talked about on the show a few weeks ago, because bisphenol A, which is used to make those nice, clear, hard bottles that people pour water in, is water-soluble, and people are worried about that leaching out. But if you're not getting water near it, like in a CD or a DVD, it's perfectly fine. And that thing is clear because it's an amorphous glass. The problem is, in bisphenol A, you get a little benzene ring, this phenyl ring. It can flip back and forth. It can rotate. And that little relaxation is enough to get polymers to change over years. So if you ever find an old polymer that's sitting in a messy office like mine for 10 years, the properties of that film or that bag or that plastic piece will be very, very different. Take, for example, polystyrene. You get anything out of polystyrene and let it sit around long enough, it gets cloudy. And it's probably not crystallizing yet. That might be some of it. But somehow it's rearranging and the additives are coalescing or they're diffusing out or they're rearranging where they are. There's lots of things in those products.
So what would be an example of that?
So this thing, polystyrene, and the example I'm going to give you is if you buy these, what's it, when I do comedy gigs, you buy this little 8.5 by 11 frame that's got a little place to put your business card in it.
Right. Okay.
And you put, you know, appearing tonight. You know, Pete and his son Dylan, who's obviously funnier than he are, is when you talk to old people. And over time, you keep that for a few years, and particularly if it goes through heat cooling cycles, it gets noticeably cloudy. It is fundamentally different properties.
Huh.
If you take a low-density polyethylene bag and sit it in the corner of your office for more than 10 years, like a friend of mine who actually has a messier office than me, you can take
Bill?
It. And no, it's actually my friend Dennis, the aviation guy. You can take it and snap it as though it's brittle. So it's no longer flexible. And that's probably not just it crystallizing, which it can do. It's probably also the interplay of the additives in there as well. But silicon oxide glass, windowpane glass, does not change over years. But in 10 years, a polymer, most polymers, will change their properties. And that's why we don't have polymers in applications that last 50, 60 years. Whereas windowpane glass, it's around for hundreds and hundreds of years. You got to replace the polymer. But they're inexpensive, and, right, and you can do that. So there you have it. Glasses. Glasses at work in your everyday life. All right. Obviously,
exciting.
Our topic is not our potpourri topic. So it's not exciting. I mean,
you put me to sleep.
Okay. But I mean, glasses are important. Do people realize that glasses are different than crystalline solids? I mean,
no.
Do people care? That's the question. What do people care about?
Glass is clear. They can see through it.
That's right, because it's amorphous. And as soon as it starts to crystallize, it's no longer clear. So I'm going to ask these our listeners the same thing I asked these folks at this comedy show last night. Oh, right down the aisle. I says, what do you people want to talk about? Nothing. I literally got... Actually, the bartender, she was very nice when I did that Daddy's Got a Gun song. She was talking about her husband and her daughter and how they argue about that sort of stuff. So, and let me leave you with this. You the day that you shut down mentally engaging people, right, is the day you might as well just pack it in. There it is, my pseudo-scientific thing on psychology. I mean, I know people like my mom. Okay, my mom, she's 81 years old. She still sends email between her friends with dirty jokes. Ali Argon, who's probably an emeritus professor at MIT in mechanical engineering, came down and gave a talk here a few months ago and, you know, had curled edges to his transparencies. He still used transparencies. He didn't use PowerPoint. He's wearing a sport jacket that I think, you know, Larry King threw out back in 1958. You know, and he's hunched over his slides and he's talking slow. And he said, you know, this guy's really old. But when you ask him a technical question and you talk to him after the talk, he is still as sharp as ever. He's as sharp as when, you know, I did research with him when I was a graduate student there. And that's the key. You know, you don't have to change your style. You can still wear, you know, your weird old clothes or whatever you're doing. But be engaging. Do stuff. Talk to people. And, you know, he's still sharp as a tack. My mom's still sharp as a tack. And that doesn't mean, you know, my mom puts a moratorium on any walking more than 2 hours. So she won't go to downtown Chicago and see museums with visiting kids or grandkids. She's like, look, 2 hours is my limit. And then I need to sit down or take a nap or something like that. And that's
better
okay.
Than me. Mine's like a half hour.
Well, yeah.
45
I mean,
minutes
you know,
at most.
The only difference between me And the people I was talking to at this retirement village were that I am not ready to admit I'm getting old yet, right? So my doctor wrote me a prescription for bifocals, but I'm still, you know, I take stuff and I'll, you know, put it at arm's length to be able to read the thing. And I finally have to, or I buy those cheap $10 reading glasses.
Right.
I don't know.
Maybe this was just like a scouting thing, you know, you went to look at a different old folk, really? Old folks home.
Yeah, but, I'm not going to this one. It's very nice, actually. Got a nice pub, but.
No sense of humor?
I need something a little more.
Vegas-y?
I don't know about Vegas-y. So, Trent, you were telling us you're going to a conference in Vegas?
Oh, yeah, security stuff, Vegas.
Oh, okay, so like Homeland Security stuff?
Not necessarily. Okay. There'll probably be Homeland Security people there.
Computer stuff, right?
But it's like network security?
Yeah.
And
yeah, stuff like that.
So it is a legitimate conference. You're not just going
What do you mean
there?
By legitimate?
Is there anything legitimate in Las Vegas?
Yeah, well, I mean, come on.
But, I mean, the American Institute of Chemical Engineers went to Reno a few years ago. And
is
I
that
don't
legitimate?
Think, I don't think we'll... Well, it was their national meeting. I don't think we'll ever be asked back because engineers don't gamble. And that's why they want you there, right? Because they figure they're going to make... I don't think they made any money off of us.
Had a collective people or a collective group where they all like went to the blackjack table and
casinos,
started counting cards.
No, but we didn't do that. They just don't do that. We're boring.
They do get very angry with people walking full, like through the casinos with large backpacks full of antennas and things. They get very nervous.
I could see that.
They'll pull you aside.
Right. But you're a mathematician. Are you a good card counter?
What? Oh, no comment.
He's not at liberty to say that.
Not that hard.
I don't know.
You make more money not counting cards anyway. There's other ways.
Okay, so you're saying by non-gambling means?
Oh, no.
Or by getting involved in the mob and taking over casinos? That was your
mind? I mean, there's lots of ways to make money in Vegas, whether the mob or whatever.
Oh, okay.
But no, card counting is easy to track. You can just, like, force cards and things.
Yeah, I would think it would be, right? And let's face it, not that many people. What do they do in blackjack? It's how many decks you? 10, 20 decks?
I have no idea what they knew.
Nowadays. But I couldn't do that. I mean, I can explain the principles to you, but I can't keep track of cards.
But nowadays, it doesn't matter.
I'd have to put on my reading glasses to see what cards are being dealt.
What are we doing?
It's practice.
So, I don't know.
People practice hours and hours a day.
All right, so we got 4 minutes here.
Yeah, two or three.
And nobody's calling. So here is the critical question. How do we better engage the public on science and technology? You're telling me I'm putting them asleep with talks of glass and the glass transition temperature. You know, we did the science of cooking.
Yeah.
We talked about nerds in the region, National Academy of Engineering. We did the movie one.
Yeah.
And the movie one where Trent had to admit on the air that he did see Ice Princess.
I did.
From Disney. Did you see Ice Princess?
No.
Okay.
You should keep it that way.
All right. And you still were not willing to admit why you were forced to watch?
Oh, no. Not at all.
Okay. All right. I'm gonna leave that one. Leave that one as a question just hanging out there. So both you guys have been sitting here listening to us yakking for a while now. What do we need to do to engage you people?
Well, I know Georgia Tech is having a K-12 initiative where they're trying to get more, scientists and engineers out of K-12 by making them interested in what we do.
Yeah.
By doing outreach stuff like having K-12, not kindergartners, but having high schoolers come here and do research. Right. Just like undergrads do research.
Right. And Bill Hunt has one of our students who was on the show before who's actually doing research for him this summer.
Didn't we do a show on that? Like,
we did.
Second show?
Yeah.
Here at REC.
And one of those guys is doing research for him.
Yeah. And so that's a start. You know?
So, but we've done those for years, right? The National Science Foundation funds those. We have Seismic, which does that very thing.
Yeah.
I mean, there's everything from the Seismic programs to the Society of Women Engineers. Bring in everyone from high school girls to Girl Scouts.
Yeah.
There's merit badges you can do. But how do we beat out the quick fix of the reality TV show?
I mean, but yeah, so what you're basically saying is how do we step up in the world of education where India and China are just trumping us in the amount of hours that a student, has.
Yeah. And I think that's another issue. It's not just, are we making it more attractive?
Well, I mean, we should even bring in my friend if she's still out there. But she's a good expert on education and Indian education and Chinese education.
All right, we do have a caller. Hold on.
We do?
Hello?
Hey.
Hello.
Welcome to Inside the Black Box. Did you have a question or comment?
I guess it's a comment. You were asking the question, how do you get the general public interested in science and that sort of thing?
Absolutely.
And, you know, I hate to say this in the context of, you know, a grand research university and such like an interesting talk about glass. But I think really for the general public, it boils down to how does it save me money, especially now, like with the gas prices and all of that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And like, it's just a matter of framing the conversation, I think, because the specifics of the science are intrinsically interesting, but it has to have an applicable point for someone to want to like learn about that and that sort of thing.
I don't think we're disagreeing with you at all.
I mean, people need a reason to change, otherwise they're not going to do it. I mean, they're still going to drive their large SUVs if gas prices weren't $4 a gallon. So, yeah, I agree with that.
And even in the context of glass, like, this is the first time I've caught this show, and I'll try to catch it again. But even in the context of glass, like, and civil engineering and building design and urban planning,
mm-hmm.
all of that stuff, to the people that, you know, are going to be funding the research and the people that are that, it boils down to, like, how does it save and or make me money?
Sure.
Which is unfortunate, I mean, in a sense, but if scientists can figure out how to answer that question, they're going to be leaps and bounds ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, back in, you know, we were talking during the break about Rockefeller and Ford, and those are two visionaries. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Ford was about how he wanted to mass produce a car. And it wasn't about money necessarily. It was about, you know, bringing this technology to the forefront. So I don't know if you have...
I don't know enough about the history of
sure.
that. But, yeah, that's...
Well, but we thank you for the call. And you make a good point that, you know, I don't think we're going to motivate everyone by money. But, you know, practical money-saving measures is a motivation we need to think about.
Yes.
All right.
What? Okay, yeah, thanks. I enjoyed the show.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, bye.
All right. So that is a very good point. The problem is, though, that in order to develop that technology that will eventually save money, right, will eventually allow us to have
sure.
energy at a reasonable cost that's not infinite, it takes money to make money.
Jeez.
Do we get another call?
We're out of time, first of all.
So. Okay.
Keep going, right. keep going.
I keep going?
Right. I keep going.
Because what are we just, trampsing over pre-recorded stuff?
Yeah, I guess so. Hold on. All right. Yeah. Let me go.
Can we take one more call without having...
See, we have a caller who actually wanted to talk about... polymers, or she was asking about glass.
Okay,
so I can
sure.
put her on.
See, so not everyone's motivated.
I told her you just talked to her after, sir, but we can do it now.
Why not? We, you know.
Yeah.
Should be
we have a 2 o'clock meeting with a grad student, but.
Okay, hold on a second. Hello?
Hello?
Okay, yeah, you're on the air, so.
Welcome to Inside the Black Box. Did you have a comment or question?
Yes, sir. I'm actually doing some research at Southern Polytechnic dealing with glass science and research, and
excellent.
I was curious if you'd talk a little bit about, like, bioactive glasses.
Well, we will talk about bioactive glasses if you tell me what a bioactive glass is.
What a bioactive... I don't know, like, I've been reading a lot about research being done with regenerative bone glasses and mm-hmm. Things of this nature, at, like, the University of London.
Ah, okay. So, I mean, that's the problem with science and technology, and this is one thing we try to wade through, is everybody takes random buzzwords and slaps them together to the point that even other scientists don't even know what people are talking about.
Yeah.
So, you know, bioactive glass.
What is it?
Those are words that you could put together. I mean, for example, you take a glass, and you can do everything from, bond... bioactive compounds to it, right? So you could actually take an enzyme, bind it to a glass, and have a solid substrate that actually catalyzes biological reactions. For example, we typically put these enzymes bound or somehow trapped in the pores of glassy particles, usually ceramic particles. This is how, for example, in a fixed bed of these particles, we turn corn syrup into high fructose corn syrup, right? We use glucose isomerase to do that. You can even do things like put little lipids on the surface. So it actually mimics a biological cell surface. It's called a biomimetic surface. So when you say bioactive surfaces or bioactive glasses, that could mean dozens of different things.
So what would be an example of a practical application of that?
Well, let me ask our caller. So what was this stuff out of London that you were talking about?
It was a bioactive glass that apparently would... they were actually trying to use them for surgical purposes where they'd create, you know, glass rods that they would surgically implant to, you know, someone with a broken leg, and it would regenerate their bone and then dissolve.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, so that's an excellent idea. And in fact, bioactive is really what everybody tries to do now. And let me give Brad an example of how that's changed the way we, for example, do hip surgery, right? If you have problems with the top of your hip, and they basically saw off that bone because it's got all sorts of problems with it, and they put in this very nice chrome moly ball joint, and then they've got this polymer socket for it, it works really well. In the old days, they used literally polymethyl methacrylate glue, plexiglass glue. And when the glue set, it got so hot, it actually scorched the bone. This is not a good thing. Now we try to take more, to borrow Brad's terminology, a green approach to it. And instead, we put little pins sticking out of the chrome moly steel, and we coat it with chemical growth factors to get the bone to grow in around it. Now, you don't heal as quickly. You have to spend much more time waiting for that to happen, but it's a much nicer, biologically sort of derived joint when that happens. So the idea of coating things with bioactive compounds, and all that is a compound that will have some biological interaction that's very, very old, that's used all the time. For example, polyethylene glycol, which you find in your food all the time, we coat everything from catheters to devices with it, because we know when the body touches that, it has less of an adverse inflammatory and immune response to it. And to be honest, we're not even sure why. All we know about that is that if you take that compound, put it in water, proteins don't like it. Thermodynamically, that's really all we understand. But we do know that if I take a little soap bubble, sort of a liposome with a drug in it, put it in your bloodstream, it will get filtered out right away. If I coat it with polyethylene glycol or something similar, it circulates much longer because the body sees it as not so hazardous. So what you're talking about is really, really commonly used. I'm not sure how to make a glass dissolve. Oh, it would probably be a polymer glass, though. Polymer glasses, they can get hydrolyzed by all the water. And let's put it this way. Most of the sutures they use now are made out of things like polylactic acid, polyglycolic acid. And when they sew up one of your organs, that dissolves and gets reabsorbed. It's a water-soluble compound. Sure. So nobody wants to go back in and take those stitches out. So. But okay, so did that even answer your question?
No, absolutely. I just it was interesting to hear someone else talk about glass from a scientific perspective, because when I started doing this, you know, I'm reading about intermediate phases, and that's what we're looking for ideally.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And a lot of materials have lots and lots of phases. Mm-hmm. All right, now Brad's writing something down here.
I'll just ask. And what's your name and location, or where are you from?
Oh, I live in Atlanta. My name's Jennifer.
Okay. Thanks, Jennifer.
But you're at, where are you at?
I'm actually at Southern Polytechnic in Marriott. I moved downtown to go to Georgia Tech, and we started doing this, so I'm staying there now.
Mm-hmm. Well, so that's cool. So Southern Poly actually used to be the biggest trade school in the state, and now they do this very practical curriculum called engineering technology. Is that what you're majoring in there? Or?
I'm actually majoring in physics, and so I kind of fell into this material science, and So I'm looking at maybe going to graduate school for material science.
So. Wow, cool. That'd be great. Cool. So do you like it out there at Southern? I live out in Marietta. It's right near where I live. So
I love it. It's very small. You know, I have small class sizes. Classes are wonderful. And
is that a plus? I mean, because Brad's giving me a look now. Like, I've taken physics here, and it's, what is it, a lecture hall with 300 people in it?
Something like that.
Exactly. It's lovely. There's 12 physics majors in my school, so when I want to talk to my professor, I can go sit down in their office and, you know.
And you actually talk to your professor?
I do. I speak with him on a one-on-one
basis. You're not afraid that he was produced by alien spawn? Because that's what they
think
of us.
I'm still afraid of Pete. Are you kidding?
And he's sitting right next to me. Well, thank you very much for the call.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you for speaking with me.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, thanks.
Uh-huh, bye-bye.
And my expert here is you're in education.
Oh, are we bringing an expert in education?
I mean, why not?
We can.
I don't know if she wants to talk.
All right, but aren't you? When do you have to go to work? Don't you have to go to work at 1?
I mean,
Trent has a real job, dude.
It's not like a 9-to-5 gig.
Oh, okay.
You know, show up, get some code in. Well, you can. It's a good day.
So, would you be aptly described as a code monkey?
Not.
Do they still use that term, code monkey?
Yeah, people still use that term. I don't know. I would say sometimes. There's more to the process.
Is that a derogatory term for a software engineer, a code monkey?
I don't know. Not so much.
Okay.
Most software engineers don't really care.
Okay. I mean, I used to work in software before I came here, and you know, they used to make the joke that the software engineers, they would just slide pizza under the door and code would come out the other side.
It's about right, yeah.
And I will take issue with anyone that says that software engineers do not have a sense of humor, because they do. And all you have to do is go to the artificial intelligence code from the Symbolics Corporation, right? Do you remember Symbolics? They made these AI machines.
Lisp machines, yeah. These things are
right.
awesome.
Right. So, and they're awesome because Lisp, it's basically open, right? So, you know, you have this code and you have access to all the source, right? Because it's not a compiled code. It's an interpreted code.
Oh, well, right? the thing with Lisp is that the code and data are the same structure.
Right, right.
So they can do whatever to it.
Exactly. So the point is all the internal comments for all the programs and systems are just there.
Well, actually, when like Netscape, they were putting out Mozilla, like Firefox or whatever, that before they made that public release, they spent, you can actually go back and they have this whole list of all the comments that were just too dirty for them to say out loud. So you can go find them. Because they went through the entire code base, took out anything they didn't want the public to see.
Okay.
Because they felt it was too dirty for their corporation. Right,
exactly.
Like and they have these online. Yes, they saved
them. I think there are some politically incorrect comments still left in the Symbolics code.
Oh, probably.
And I don't think Symbolics is anymore.
Nope.
So are we going to bring our education expert
online?
I don't
know. Does she want to talk? She's too scared to talk.
She's making the international symbol for, no, you people should be institutionalized. I'm not going on the air.
Yeah. But so we were talking about K-12 education and outreach, right?
Yeah.
And how, you know, India and China are just trumping us.
Yeah.
What, don't they go to school from like 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. or something?
Right.
Actually, now they have shorter sessions. There is a website that you can...
So why don't you talk into the microphone instead of...
Yeah, you're just talking to the microphone. All right.
Why are you talking into a microphone?
Right here. Yeah, I can. Okay. No, we had a caller who called to say that he worked or knew some computer programmer, and he had a sign on his wall that said, "Computer programmer is a red-eyed mumbling man who can converse with inanimate objects." And he was,
And he just called to share that comment?
Yes, share the
comment.
Is that a true
comment?
I think that was a sense of humor thing, too.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We should do this like, what is it? Who's the guy who screams? Is that the McLaughlin Report? All right, our computer programmer is crazy. Trent, wrong. Brett, wrong. I called you Brett twice now already.
It's a metamucil.
No, they do have a sense of humor. I agree. I just, well, I don't know. We'll wait and see.
I don't know if you agree.
Well, that worries me a lot because Lou Lefton, who has not been on this show yet, but he was on our show back when we were in Sandy Springs. He's a mathematician. He's in charge of the computers for the math department here.
Okay.
His PhD in mathematics. Do you know Lou?
I think so. Yeah,
so Lou does improv comedy. He teaches it. And Bill's mentioned this on the show before. He teaches it to middle school and high school kids. He's also a stand-up comedian. Whenever I perform with him, I like to introduce him as, you know, this is Lou Lefton. He's a mathematician. He's a comedian. He's funny, and he can prove it. And you're right. Only mathematicians get that joke and get his mime in four dimensions. I mean, if the only jokes that you appreciate are jokes like, I believe there are 11 types of people in the world, those that understand binary, those that don't, and those that don't, but will laugh at this joke anyway. I mean, okay, and even the mathematician is shaking his head. But I'm not going to apologize for that, especially among you old people, because you're the ones that foisted the new math on us. So do you guys remember studying number bases? You know, base 2, base 10? Did you guys study that in elementary school?
No, we did not study that in elementary school. No.
Really? Maybe they got rid of it already. Rats. Because that started in the 60s. And that was the new math. The new math was set theory. Oh, so we got the education person loving this. Set theory, number bases, weird stuff like that.
Good stuff.
More abstract. No, but set theory is important.
I think very much so.
We had no idea how important number bases were until computers came along. And as a comedian, I can now make jokes in, you know, hexadecimal, octal, and binary. And we made a lot of jokes about a friend of mine who just turned 40 or 50 in octal or 23 in hexadecimal or whatever you want. Well, he's a computer programmer. So not just the jokes, but here's the funny thing. Now I understand when I try to teach my students.
It'd be 24, wouldn't it?
Is it 24?
Okay, no, 24.
2 times 16 is 32. 28.
Yeah, 28. It doesn't end with a 3. I know that.
Okay, right, because then that would be 36. Yeah. Oh, wait, that would be
3 times 16.
It'd be something odd.
But here's the problem. My own students, sophomores here at Georgia Tech, when I try to explain binary to them, they don't understand binary.
What?
They have to take a class in it. Eventually.
Well, do they learn that in the basic computer science course?
No,
I don't think they do.
It's in circuits and electronics.
Okay, so when you do digital stuff.
Yeah, digital, that's when you have to learn to go from.
I don't think we have the double A course as a requirement anymore.
You don't?
We replaced it with biology to reflect the changing research interests of this planet of ours.
Yeah, I don't know when you learn binary here. I mean, I work with computers. I can't remember when I didn't know binary stuff.
But you just explained that, you know, the first column in a number is whatever that base is to the zero power,
well, like
or
the reason,
ones, right?
Yeah.
And the next one is the base, and then the base squared, and the base cubed, and, you know. So if it's 2, 1, 0, and that joke was originally there are 10 types of people in the world, those that understand binary, those that don't. So it's 1, 2, and 0, 1s.
But the thing about that joke is you wouldn't actually say 10. You'd say like 10 binary or something.
You would 10 binary.
Or you say 1, 0 or something.
Okay, but you know,
it's a confusing joke to start with.
So, all right, so now he's the comedian, the comedy critic as well.
Yeah. Got you.
All right, we have fallen to a new low here on Inside the Black Box, ladies and gentlemen.
That's something.
I think we're just about to invite wandering people off the street into the studio.
There we go, right here.
They used to do that on 96.1, and they didn't like that too much, I don't think.
Really? This is 96.1.1, that now has Project 961.
I think so, yeah. They would invite random people on the street, yeah.
All right, what is the name of our education expert who's in the studio with us today?
Anu Parvatier.
Okay, so Anu is so terrified of the thought of talking to three nerds that she won't even go on the air with us.
It's kind of ridiculous.
What, that she's terrified of us?
The show until this point.
That's okay. You really didn't miss much, because today was, what was it, gentlemen? Potpourri Day.
Where you learned that you can pour oil on potpourri.
Green glass or something like that.
I don't know.
I didn't want to jump in the middle of
All right. So we talked about, what did we talk about? We should wrap up eventually, because
Trent has a
job. He has to go to work.
You don't rely on my dad for an excuse.
Oh, okay. Well, you just use us as an excuse to get out of work. Okay, so...
And what do you have to do today?
What we were, I have a 2 o'clock meeting. to talk to my graduate students about RNA simulation and bulk simulations of ring opening metathesis polymerization polynorbornene. And that is not going to engage anyone on the air. But, no, we were talking about the fact that why is it that other industrialized nations kick our butts in education? Can I say butts with FCC?
Sure.
Yeah,
okay.
Maybe if you didn't bring so much attention
why?
To it.
Why? Yeah, why?
Well, actually, what my friends, and let's see if our education expert agrees. My friends from the Department of Education tell me that for years we have tried to jam too much curriculum into too little time. So we teach them so many different topics that they learn, what is it, nothing about everything. Whereas other students that don't get quite as much jammed in but get drilled more on the basics and the fundamentals learn the fundamentals of math and things like that better. So they do better on those tests when they compare to us. And I'm getting
I think we focus on a breadth of knowledge and we don't quite achieve the depth.
Yeah.
So by the time students get to college, they don't really have the depth to understand how to obtain the rest of the depth that they need.
Exactly.
So they end up specializing in a field and there's a gap between what they've learned in the public school system or in the K-12 education system and how they've learned it. And now they're expected to come to college or come to a graduate program and learn the depth.
Right.
And they just don't have the capacity to do that. So that has been an argument made. And then in some cases, the depth that they're learning in other countries is just much deeper. They're learning, you know, harder math skills. They're learning more advanced science skills
really
because they
know
can.
Those fundamentals. Mm-hmm. Right. Whereas we might be exposed to more goofy, flowery potpourri stuff like what we're talking about in the air now.
Yeah.
But, you know, can they really do integration by parts as well as someone from another country?
I remember the day I was in one of my math classes and one of the theorems was actually named after one of the guys who works in the math department.
Uh-huh.
It's like, wow, I finally got to the point where someone's alive that is actually one of the theorems I'm working on.
And is that a good thing for mathematicians?
I guess.
It
feels less old.
But what I don't get is when I went to China, the difference between the amount, I'm always from the business perspective, about how much an engineer in China gets paid versus an engineer in America gets paid.
Yeah, relative to, say, business people. Right.
What?
I mean, you got to put it on a scale, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, a Chinese engineer gets paid like $8,000 American, whereas an American engineer coming out of college gets paid $55,000 as the average, which I think is crazy. I mean, so I don't know where.
Oh, so you're talking in absolute standards.
Cost of living also is different, and you cannot recruit. You can't recruit an American engineer to China and say we're going to pay you 1/10 of what you would make in the United States. Come to China.
Yeah.
Who's going to go for that? You know, it's just we grew up on a different standard.
All right, she's not talking to the mic, but she's basically saying you're goofy.
Yeah.
I think.
She's
well, but I mean, that's just. But here's the thing. Isn't that going to even out as we isn't that going to even out? That means China's going to come up, Korea's going to come up, a lot of places are going to come up, and we are going to stay the same or go down.
I mean, I would think we'd go down. I mean, I don't see how we can go up.
This is the sacrifice I was talking about before for green energy that Americans just don't want to make that. So here's the lecture I give my students in the beginning chemical engineering course when they can't do a simple mass or energy balance, and they think I'm just really mean. I say, look, you can't just crank the numbers. You have to crank the numbers and be innovative about it and tell me what this means and how you would change the design. I said, because I can get in the former Soviet Union, in one of these Eastern Bloc countries, an entire army of PhDs at a university who can do the math better than you, don't even need computers to do it because they learn to do it without it because they haven't had computers. And I can get them for, you know, a fifth or a sixth of what we're paying you coming out of here with a bachelor's degree.
Sure.
So you have to be better. You have to be innovative. You have to think. You can't just go, okay, I'm going to glue my calculator to my left hand and just sort of do a lot of calculations.
Sure.
Plugging in the numbers is not what they're being paid for. And I will say this, that I was talking about Lou Lufton before. Lou Lufton and I are actually working on a proposal to use improv comedy techniques to help engineers innovate, think outside the box, do what's called associative and lateral thinking. They've been using it in business for years. And the real question is, can you teach engineers improv comedy techniques or any sort of outside the box, goofy brainstorming thing? And I don't know. And the point is, I think a little of that is useful because, I mean, I don't know what your guys' curriculum is like, but our curriculum, which I think we've tried to evolve, try to make it the best we can, until they get to that final senior design thing, they don't get to think a lot. They're just like, here's some formulas, crank it up.
I mean, we talked to, I mean, even came to it, the ME design thing.
The ME robotics design is a good example of creativity. Yeah.
And that's a sophomore level.
Yeah, and maybe we need more of those. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You don't really, in all math classes, like you don't really do that many proofs until like 4,000 level. That's pretty much like the way it is in the math department.
Okay, so you just learn stuff.
Yeah, that's because most of the things lower than that, math majors don't take them. Or, I mean, people. Yeah, math majors don't take it. Like, I don't get credit if I took some, like, 3,000 level math classes from the math department. Like, they wouldn't give me credit for it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so I don't know. But there's less, under like, courses below 4,000 in math. So you usually blow through those in, like, a year or two and then take all the proof ones.
Right, but do you dirty your hands with something we like to call applied mathematics?
Applied mathematics.
That is a dirty word over there in the math department.
Yeah, some places.
I've known many of your former math, applied mathematics. All right. But what we're trying to wrap up now?
I mean, yeah.
All right, so you tell me, what have we learned today? Other than the fact that
potpourri.
We can kill more than an hour when the guest doesn't show up. Glasses are still poorly understood.
Right.
But they have practical ramifications. Because even though the window doesn't change, don't use any plastic for any engineering thing that's been hanging around more than 20 years. Huh. It's changed.
And then our caller mentioned bioactive glasses.
Yeah. So we should do something on bio surfaces, biomimetic surfaces.
Yeah.
This is really hot. Almost everything that they stick in you nowadays at a hospital has some kind of surface treatment.
Yeah.
So we should do that. I could actually get my friend Elliot Chekhov.
Our education expert did a good research design project on, what was it? Do you want to explain it?
I'm not a public education.
Okay.
She could tell you, but she'd have to kill you.
That's cool.
So, and this education, I didn't realize it was top secret.
Yeah, apparently.
And
what else did we learn?
Okay, we learned that you're not a big fan of the new jetpack, even though it's not actually a jet.
We talked about green energy for a half hour.
Yeah.
And how to change society towards a greener future, I guess.
And at least my opinion, it's only my opinion, is, yeah, we can fix this technologically, but we have to be willing to make sacrifices economically and culturally. So, will we be able to do that? That's the question.
I think we have to.
All right.
Unless we want to. I mean, if we want to stay the most advanced and technologically efficient country in the world,
we need to start making some changes. So there's the national pride angle that you're working there.
Yeah.
All right. Now, hopefully, you guys are going to be out of town next week, but hopefully we'll get an engineer here.
Yeah, I'll grab somebody.
And we will be able to talk to the nerd girls and dispel any stereotypes of women working in science and technology. So hopefully you will join us next week on that very fascinating topic here on Inside the Black Box on WREK Atlanta.